Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, December 4th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news and culture magazine. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. In today's show, we learn about a new effort to combat domestic violence in the Valley, and we hear a two-part series on housing scams that target senior citizens. We also introduce a new series where two people 60 years apart in age chime in on various topics.
But first, when you hear the phrase brain drain, what comes to mind? Young people fleeing ag-based cities like Fresno or Bakersfield for the bright lights of Los Angeles or San Francisco? Well, last month, business news company Bloomberg released its annual Brain Drain Index. It uses census data to analyze which American cities are losing advanced degree holders, white-collar jobs, and STEM career opportunities. And topping that list this year is Hanford, California? FM 89's Laura Sitsui has this story from Kings County.
Chelsea Hutchison is a teacher with the Business Academy at Sierra Pacific High School. Every year, she has her students shadow professionals, but sometimes she has to look way beyond Hanford.
And it's a hard task for these kids because they have to find their own transportation for that day. And I have kids last year that went all the way up to Clovis, Fresno, Madera, even to San Francisco to Google. So we have students that really, the reality sets in like, oh, I couldn't stay in Hanford even if I wanted to because there's no options for the career choice that I have.
She says her students who aren't pursuing careers in agriculture really struggle to find their niche.
I know there's been a lot of talk where, because it's so much cheaper to live here, that it might be a place where big businesses can come and run their manufacturing or run their business, and they could have quite a bit of individuals. It's just we have to get more people to come with the degrees so that the business says, okay, yeah, well, there's people that can fill the jobs.
Some of the students taking her classes say Hanford can't support their career dreams, like Caitlin Thayer. She's planning to attend college in Southern California before going to law school.
Being an attorney and then eventually a judge is just something I've always been really interested in. I really like my small town of Hanford, and I really think that even branching out to Fresno, which isn't that small of a city either, I think that it would be, I think it's a great career choice because in Hanford, you don't get a lot of civil court cases, you know, not as much as you would in Fresno.
Student Micah Campos is also planning to head to Southern California.
I want to go to LA to see if I can find something there.
There's not a lot of people or businesses here that are in film. I know that there's one person here that's a videographer, maybe two or three, but I would probably like to come back and maybe do something in the film industry here. It'd be pretty cool.
But Lance Lippincott with the Kings County Economic Development Corporation says the region has some great opportunities.
One of the coolest water engineering jobs I've heard of in the county is out at the Surf Ranch. I mean, all of that, I mean, where would you think in the middle of the Central Valley there's a surf ranch that needs hydro engineers in order to, you know, build a wave, build the perfect wave? And those guys are doing it in board shorts and flip-flops half the time.
Lippincott disagrees with Bloomberg's premise. He says even the agricultural companies in Hanford are becoming more technology-driven.
If you look at what's the traditional classical definition of white-collar, banker, lawyer, doctor, everything like that, I think that definition's evolved. I mean, you've got farmers who are doing application-based, using iPads and everything else, irrigation.
He says that you can't compare ag-based economies to tech giants like San Francisco and Silicon Valley.
And it's kind of like, not to put it simplistically, it's kind of like boxing. Boxing has weight classes for a reason. I mean, you wouldn't put a heavyweight against a featherweight because that doesn't make sense.
But Bloomberg reporter Vinnie Del Giudice says that Hanford shares traits with those bigger cities, like having a business district and nearby suburbs. In fact, Bloomberg looked at over 400 metropolitan and micropolitan communities altogether. Del Giudice says that Hanford intrigued him.
It was just an area of California that's ignored, maybe. It's not, you know, along the coast. It's another part of the state, and there's a lot of promise like many places do, and we thought that was a good angle to lead with.
Del Giudice says communities have moved on and off the brain drain index over the years, so the ranking isn't, in his words, a death sentence.
In many cases, we talk to cities, they're on the brain drain list. They're turning around. They were cities, I should say, or regions or counties that were dependent on single industries.
Del Giudice knows the Central Valley has been experiencing a drought, and that has likely contributed to job loss. Daryl Pyle, Hanford's city manager, says that it's not just that agriculture has dominated the city's economy. There are limited education options beyond high school.
Obviously, if we had a four-year university, you know, in Kings County, we would be more competitive on some of those technical career opportunities. I think we're a ways away from getting a four-year university in Kings County. But that's a battle we will continue to fight until our students have easier access to upper education.
That's partly why Thayer and Campos, the students we heard from earlier, are planning to leave Hanford after graduating. But then there are those who will return, like Noah Frank. His plan is this.
Eventually, after I get out of the Navy to become a U.S. history teacher, and most likely come back here to Hanford and teach.
Frank has lived all over the country, but he says Hanford is where he wants to put down roots. However, there is one job he's hoping for that he would have to leave the Central Valley to pursue.
I mean, one day it'd be a dream for me to run for president in the United States. I mean, it's always something I'd want to be in, go into politics, maybe after education, but who knows?
Frank is optimistic about Hanford's future, and that's just the vote of confidence the town wants to hear more of. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
Wherever you live in the Valley, whether it's Hanford or Tehachapi or Merced, we all have to contend with the flu season. It's already claimed one life in Kern County. Last year, the CDC estimates the flu killed 80,000 Americans. 80,000. That puts influenza among the top 10 deadliest conditions in the U.S., up there with cancers, heart disease, and diabetes. There's an easy way to reduce the risk of flu, the flu shot, but around 60% of Americans choose not to get it. Why so much hesitation? I asked Dr. Jessica Mason, a faculty member at UCSF Fresno and an emergency physician at Community Regional Medical Center. One reason for doubt, she says, is most of us don't really know what the flu is.
It gets confused with the quote-unquote stomach flu, which is not actually influenza at all. Influenza is, imagine the worst cold of your life, where you get horrible fevers and chills and you feel like you're gonna die.
Unfortunately, many do. In the last 5 years, the flu has killed 1,100 Californians. It's sent another 2,600 to the ICU. But a mistaken flu identity can't be the only reason people avoid the flu shot. I set out to find a skeptic. I didn't have to go far.
I wouldn't say that I'm a denier or anything. I think I just really don't have enough information.
That's Monica Velez, a reporter here at FM89, and she says she hasn't gotten the flu shot in years. It's a similar story for Laura Satsui, another reporter here who calls herself flu shot ambivalent.
It was easy when I was in college, but now that I work, it's just like not a part of my routine and has never been, you know, a habit.
But they were willing to consider it this year.
All right, you guys ready?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
So they agreed to come with me to a flu shot clinic in East Central Fresno.
You can go ahead and register right here.
We met a friendly woman with a big, warm smile.
I'm Letitia Berber. I'm a health educator for the Fresno County Department of Public Health. And we are here giving out free flu vaccines.
Laura and Monica came prepared with questions.
So my family is constantly like, we never get sick. And so part of me is like, oh, my immune system is totally fine. With that in mind, like, why should I still get the flu shot?
Let's say you have your grandmother living with you. Let's say you have a 5-month-old nephew that cannot get vaccinated. So you are protecting those individuals, not just yourself.
That's very altruistic.
It's known as herd immunity. The flu is highly contagious, but Berber says the vaccine can prevent it from spreading.
And has it been, like, proven that this is the way where you can avoid getting hospitalized because you got the flu?
Yes. The flu vaccine is the number one, it's the best method to protect yourself against the flu.
Of course, the vaccine is nowhere near perfect. It's around 40 to 60% effective.
It may not sound like a lot, but Berber says it's enough to protect against some strains of the flu and make the others less severe.
Is it a live flu that I'm about to be injected with?
This is a dead virus. The vaccine will contain a dead virus, meaning that it will not make you sick. It doesn't have its ability to make you sick.
And Berber says that right there is the number one concern people bring up, getting sick from the vaccine. She says, yes, the flu shot will probably make your arm sore, and it could give you sniffles, muscle aches, and even a fever. But that's your body's immune system going into overdrive. It's not the flu or its dangerous complications.
You may feel a little sick where you don't want to go to work, you want to stay in bed, and it'll go away 2 to 3 days. Flu can last up 2 weeks.
Yeah, so it's normal to feel a little sick, but I mean, it's not the flu. It's just...
It's rare, but it could happen.
And it kind of almost, like, to me, it seems like people almost get into, like, conspiracy theories of, like, putting in purposely bad things. Like, have you heard that at all? Or...
Yeah, no, that is another myth where the vaccine contains some type of hormone that will affect me, affect my fertility, I won't have any, be able to have children. So many myths out there, we heard them all.
Then there's the toxic metal mercury. Berber says most vaccines don't contain it anymore, but some batches of the flu shot do. Even then, the FDA says it's on par with the amount of mercury in a can of tuna. You should be able to request a mercury-free batch. Health experts also say there's no evidence the flu vaccine suppresses natural immunity, another very common concern, though it is an active area of research. Regardless, the virus mutates over time into different strains. So even if you overcome one flu strain and build up immunity to it, the next year's strain will be different, and you could still die from it. As for Laura and Monica, they felt good about what they had heard.
All right, are we doing it now?
Good enough to get their first flu shots in years.
You're going to complete one of these and I take it to the nurse.
Okay.
The process was smooth and easy.
Thank you so much.
It started with a quick form with some screener questions.
Any chance that any of you can be pregnant?
No.
No, definitely not.
Then they were ushered to a nurse's station, where a public health nurse named Jeannie Rodriguez pulled each syringe out of a cooler in a sterilized, single-use package.
I'm going to wipe your arm. And then I'm going to pinch your arm a little bit. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. There it is.
Is that it?
That was it.
Really?
Yep.
A small pinch to prevent a big problem. If you're curious about the flu shot, you can ask your county's public health department or look it up with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. You can get the flu shot at doctor's offices and pharmacies like CVS.
Seniors are among the most vulnerable to the flu. And in this next story, we learn that they're also targets for con artists. Amid California's record-shattering housing prices, the state's senior homeowners are sitting on a gold mine. As part of a statewide collaboration covering the California dream, KPBS's Amita Sharma looks at the tricks scammers use.
70-year-old Marianne Welsh has always wanted to pass down the 2-bedroom Sunnyvale home she inherited from her mom to her 7 grandchildren. So imagine how she felt when she went to her mailbox in 2016.
I opened a letter.
It contained completed paperwork to buy her house.
And I was surprised because it's not for rent or for sale or for anything.
The letter offered to pay Welsh $750,000 for a house that is a young techie's dream, a house that is within walking distance of Apple, Google, and LinkedIn, and a house that is worth more than $1.5 million. The letter even came complete with directions on where the sender hoped Welsh would sign her consent to sell.
That makes me very, very, very angry, to say the least. If they're doing it to me, they're going to be doing it to others.
They are.
We've been seeing an uptick in cases that involve direct solicitations to elderly homeowners to sell their homes, potentially for well below fair market value.
No official statewide stats exist on real estate fraud against seniors, but anecdotally, prosecutors across California, like Santa Clara County Deputy District Attorney Cherie Ballard, says it's enough of a problem to merit warning the elderly. She believes California's superheated housing market is what is driving scammers. So is the age of their targets.
And they remember buying their home for $40,000, but in these crazy upswings of market value, they have no idea that their property might be worth $800,000, $1 million, $2 million.
Real estate opportunists find their prey trolling public records. Santa Clara County Real Estate Fraud Coordinator Duane Shuaga says they then target seniors with flyers, sometimes asking ominous questions like these.
Do you want to cash out before war with North Korea breaks out?
Or,
third notice, how much longer before I hear from you? And the homeowner says, hey, I never got a first or second notice.
It took two notices to 84-year-old Carol Law and her 89-year-old husband, George, offering to buy their one-acre lot in eastern San Diego County before they got mad. They estimate the land is worth $50,000. They were offered $800 in cash.
The first time, I thought it was just a stupid joke. The second time, I thought, this guy's up to something.
He can send out hundreds of those. You hit once, you make a fortune.
They speculated the person carefully picked them to lowball.
It looked like he was just thinking, okay, these guys have had this since 1979. They're very old now. They probably are a little goofy.
Prosecutors say some scammers go door to door to find senior homeowners, or they go to public places, even churches. And strangers aren't the only ones trying to steal real estate from the elderly. Relatives try too. California Attorney General Javier Becerra says seniors and sincere relatives should be aware of these scams. He urged people to report real estate fraud quickly. And he suggests that seniors save every document in case a real estate deal goes south.
And always keep good evidence, keep your records, and know that there are people you could turn to who, for a living, try to protect our community.
In San Diego, I'm Amita Sharma.
We'll come back to the second installment in this series at the end of the show. We've heard a lot about how government policies in San Joaquin Valley cities and beyond have led to race and class segregation for more than a century. Now, a UC Merced political science professor has written a book about this phenomenon called Segregation by Design: Local Politics and Inequality in American Cities. Reporter Monica Velez spoke with author Jessica Traunstein about her new book.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the book starts out with this comic strip that shows the experience of a couple who's trying to buy a home. And so I'm wondering, why do you think it was important to start off the book like that? And, you know, what kind of understanding do you hope that people get from that?
Well, I collaborated with an artist, Derek Ritter, to create this comic version of the book. We try to tell the story through the eyes of a couple that is shopping for a home. And in the course of shopping for the home, they begin to understand the process of segregation and how the United States became segregated in the way that it is. And that's the story that I tell in the rest of the book with lots and lots of academic evidence and arguments.
And so you find that local governments have, in fact, like, played a part in race and class segregation, and actually, like, for decades.
That's right. So I start the book in the 1890s. And when I began researching the book, I thought, oh, I'll go back to, you know, the 1960s or 1970s. And the more I got into the research, the more I realized that I kept having to go back in time, because these processes started at the very beginning when cities first became urban places in the United States. And in the late 1800s, we were still a predominantly agricultural nation. And throughout the early part of the 1900s, the Industrial Revolution started to bring huge numbers of people into cities. And as cities grew, they began to implement the processes that I talk about in the book, which is to segregate neighborhoods. And local governments played a starring role in determining who would live in which neighborhoods, whether we would have integrated neighborhoods with people of color and whites living next door to each other and renters and homeowners living next door to each other, or whether those groups of people would really live in separate places. And when they live in separate places, this is what we refer to as segregation, of course.
And you found out that that was actually intentional, right?
That's right. So this is part of the reason why I had to go back to the beginning, because now, well, if you move to a new place today, just like the couple in the comic that we describe at the beginning of the book, most people are not intentionally trying to segregate themselves, but they are looking for housing in communities that have been segregated a long time ago. And so I wanted to go back to the very beginning to try to understand, why did these neighborhoods become segregated in this way? And why did city policies get passed in order to produce this segregation? And what I learned was that it was intentional. The idea was to make separate neighborhoods for white residents and for home-owning residents, and to make sure that people of color and renters and poorer individuals were not able to live in those neighborhoods.
Can you give us some examples of, you know, like how the government did that, like what they would place in certain areas?
Sure. So one of the most common ways that cities create segregation is through zoning or other land use regulation. And a zoning law basically says you can place some kinds of businesses and residences in this part of town, but not in this other part of town. And we think of zoning as being a very useful kind of policy, right? We want to make sure that we don't have liquor stores right next to elementary schools. Those are good kinds of uses of zoning. But zoning is also used to make sure that certain types of housing doesn't get built in certain types of places, that apartment complexes don't end up being built near to single-family homes. And even further than that, there are lots of different kinds of land use regulations that determine exactly how the housing is going to look in a particular neighborhood. So land use regulations can define what the minimum lot size is, which means how big does the piece of property have to be that the house is going to be built on. And you can imagine that if there's a very large minimum lot size, that piece of property is going to become more expensive. There are other kinds of land use regulations that cities can engage in that determine who lives where and what parts of the city are nicer than others. And those might be simple things like where streets get paved and where they don't get paved. Or it might be even bigger issues like where to put the recycling plant or where to put the public park. And again, when cities decide where to place these kinds of amenities and negative uses, that can affect the entire neighborhood around that place. If a city decides to build a big new public park in a neighborhood, that is likely to increase the property values, increase the desirability of that neighborhood. And cities make strategic decisions about where they're going to place the parks and the garbage dumps and where they're going to pave the streets and where they're not.
Do you see these issues relatable to Merced?
I do. So, you know, I don't study Merced or the San Joaquin Valley specifically in the book, but there are certainly lots of lessons and processes that are exactly the same here in the San Joaquin Valley as they are elsewhere in the United States. And one of the things that I think people often find surprising about my writing is that some people will imagine that problems like segregation or attempts to ensure that white communities are separated from people of color, maybe that only happened a long time ago, or it only happens in the South, or some other geographically defined region. And what I find is it happens everywhere, and it has happened for more than 100 years throughout the United States. And the goal typically has been to make sure that people have high property values, people with political power have high property values, and access to high-quality public services, so schools and public safety and road maintenance.
I know that this applies, your book applies to cities all over the country, but did you find that there are any cities that maybe are a little bit more progressive and, I don't know, maybe kind of trying to change this or have done things to change this?
There are a lot of cities that have made a great deal of effort trying to change these patterns. And you can see examples of this throughout the history of the United States. But there's no single city that I can say has gotten it all right. There are certainly places, and actually many of the cities in California are less segregated and more diverse than many of the cities in the Midwest or the East. And so in that way, we might say that California has done a better job of preventing segregation than some other places in our country. But I wouldn't want to say that we're doing well, right? We're still, the entire United States is still a very segregated place. And one of the lessons that I learned in writing this book is that as segregation in some places has changed, it maybe gotten better in some places, then it often gets worse in other places. And so overall, we still are a very segregated nation.
What do you hope people realize after reading this book? Do you think that it could maybe like bring a change in local government?
Well, that would be a wonderful outcome. You know, I think one of the things that I would like people to understand from this is that even if they have they don't have any desire in their heart to generate segregation or to produce these bad outcomes, that sometimes we make decisions individually that can lead to these patterns anyway. And so I guess if there's sort of a single lesson to be learned for individuals, it's that we should all be paying more attention to what our city governments are doing and making sure that the policies of land use are inclusive rather than exclusive.
Once again, we are talking to political science professor at UC Merced, Jessica Traunstein. She just wrote Segregation by Design, Local Politics, and Inequality in American Cities. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And now we're going to introduce you to an occasional series we're calling Mind the Gap, where we ask both a young person and a much older person for their take on topics both personal and political. So for our first Mind the Gap, you'll meet Raymart Katakutin. He's 18, attends Fresno City College, and works at a thrift store in the Tower District. And you'll hear from Rosemarie Carrillo. She's almost 80, and she's very active in her church, where her husband of 59 years was the pastor. But he died in September, and it's been really tough. One way she passes the time is to shop in the same thrift store where Raymart works.
My name is Raymart Katakutan. I know for sure I have a drive to help people. So I'm very focused on what I want to be rather than what I am right now. I've seen a lot of blame being put, especially when it comes to things like elections. There's a lot of push for, okay, the youth need to vote, yeah, rock the vote. But then when there's low voter turnout for the youth because we don't support what's being pushed upon us, I think we're targeted. So I think a lot of blame is being put on us specifically in the situation that we were born into, you know, revolving around the economy or technology or how we're progressing. I think that a lot of the people my age are in a very stressful position to advance.
My name is Rosemarie Carrillo. I see my future. I'm going to church, and I go to ladies' retreats, and I'm really involved with the young girls, counseling them, talking with them, liking them, helping them. I think I'm ready. No, I know I'm ready. If God's going to come today or tomorrow, I'm ready. I've been in the church all my life. I don't know anything else. I've never been to a bar or to a this or to a that. No, I don't know. What is it to drink a beer or smoke a cigarette? I don't know that stuff. So I have always just been involved in church, church, church. I don't know if that's good or bad, but that's my life.
I think the first thing a lot of people see about me is my race. So, like, there's a lot of stereotypes that come with that, you know, being an Asian American man. And so I think people perceive me specifically with the how I look outwards rather than how I may interact with people. So the things I wear, the thing, how I look, I've been called a hooligan on several occasions. So I think that's like a lot of the stuff I hear. But I think once people that actually like interact with me, I think they could see I'm a kind-hearted person deep down, you know?
I'm 80 years old. How much more time do I have in this planet? I'm not going to be here much longer. Now that my husband passed, I'm packing all his stuff to give to, we have a man in our church that's 82 years old. So I'm planning on giving it all to him.
He's a representative of a lot of the people in America. So whatever I think about the president is whatever I think about, like, the state that our country, our nation is in. So when we say our president doesn't support this, doesn't do that, then you have to look at, well, people voted for this man, you know? So I do not, I will straight up say I don't support Mr. Donald Trump, but I do say that he's an accurate reflection of what I've seen a lot in the community.
President Trump, no, we just have to pray for that guy, that he goes far away or does something with himself. Barbara Bush, she was my favorite. I just love that lady because she was so firm and she talked so rough in a way. And I like Barbara Bush.
There's a lot of closed-mindedness from older generations because a lot of systematic ideals that were pushed upon older generations. And that's not saying, okay, if I meet this older person, they're going to think I'm this way. They're going to have these assumptions towards me already, because that would be me judging already. But I think the difference is being able to communicate in a different way. And I think if that's always going to be the situation, no matter what generation. Like I see my third grade nephew already learning how to do Google Drive. And I already hear his music, and I'm like, man, all this sounds the same.
I think some of them are in a hurry. They're in a hurry, and a lot of them have their parents do a lot for them. But we're supposed to let them do some of their stuff themselves.
People in my age group are honestly some of the most amazing innovators I've ever seen. So much drive and diversity. I think there's a push now for people in my age group to succeed. And that drive comes from us personally. Nobody's implementing these ideas into us like, okay, you have to be this, you have to be a doctor, lawyer, a person can be an artist, every person has a contribution to the world. And I think now more than ever, the youth have a freedom to choose their route.
February the 24th, I'm going to turn 80. And I never want a birthday party. I've always told my daughters, no birthday parties. But this time on my 80th, I'm going to have a birthday party.
Now, we're going to turn to a Fresno-based organization that helps Valley communities access healthy foods and safe places to exercise. But with a new grant, Cultiva la Salud is spreading its reach to help prevent domestic violence among Latina immigrants. The grant was awarded by the Nonprofit Prevention Institute and the Blue Shield of California Foundation. FM89's Monica Velez spoke with Cultiva la Salud's program director, Genoveva Islas, who began by explaining what the grant covers.
So what we've gotten is a $50,000 grant that is a planning grant. So we have a year to come together and talk about those things that would allow us to create prevention of domestic violence reframing it another way, helping to grow safe relationships. Safety through connections. And so we're really excited to be one of the communities that they funded. We will work in this year to create our plan. And once our plan is submitted, there is an opportunity to have it funded for implementation after this year.
You are one of the five organizations in the state to be picked for this grant. And so why do you think that they chose your organization that's based in Fresno?
I think we put together a really strong proposal. Our proposal is targeting work with Latina immigrants in Fresno County. And there's a lot of reasons why, you know, this particular population is vulnerable. When you look at them, the Latino community as a whole, there are lower levels of educational attainment by new immigrants. They are often having to take very low-paying jobs. They're often exploited for their labor. They also, because of being immigrants, they've moved away from their social connections and networks. That creates a level of vulnerability. I think we were selected because it was a strong proposal and because we were specifically targeting a population who historically has been really underserved. So I'm excited about the opportunity. I'm the child of Mexican immigrants. My mother came to this country, you know, with the idea that she would have more opportunity for herself and for her children. You know, it was the same on my father's side. So I am very vested in this idea of how we create resiliency and protective factors for these immigrant women who really impact all of our lives, from their efforts as farm laborers to the various jobs that they do in helping to care for and protect our communities.
In terms of domestic violence, do you feel like, mm-hmm. you know, that group of Latina immigrants, are they particularly vulnerable to being in situations of domestic violence?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mentioned a few factors already, but I think one of the other issues that creates vulnerability for them is because if they have irregular documentation or immigration status, they're less likely to report if some abuse is happening to them or some violence. And also because they often are not English literate, part of the challenge with those services and resources that exist is that they're often not culturally sensitive to some of the issues that are challenges within the Latino community. You know, as with many groups, there is a lot of stigma about the idea that your marriage is failing or that, you know, your husband is a bad person or your partner is abusing you. And so there are cultural issues that create limitations also in them being active about seeking help. So I do think that there are issues because of their status and because of cultural things that do create greater vulnerability for them.
And do you feel like because in a lot of their native countries, do you mm-hmm. feel like because maybe they feel like they can't, I guess, maybe fully trust their government? Do you think that kind of translate when they come, you know? Here?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. And if we reflect on what's happening right now, I mean, certainly a lot of the immigrants that are fleeing, you know, from South America and Central America and Mexico, they are definitely coming because of the violence and threats that exist to them in their home countries. So I would say yes, that I do think that's probably a variable and a factor affecting them, is this idea that their government haven't really been resources that have been protecting them. We're talking about work that is about building the resiliency of women, you know, helping them develop their self-worth, their self-love so that they can, you know, have the courage to leave those relationships. But also that if we instill these ideas of worth and courage, that they could be protective factors in preventing them from even getting involved in bad relationships. That's, I think, the intent of safety through connection. So we want to move the conversation from just what we do to help protect victims to actually what we can do to prevent domestic violence.
You guys didn't start specifically working domestic violence prevention. So I'm curious, what made you guys want to kind of go kind of do more work into this issue? Yeah. Did you get like maybe some people kind of asking you guys about it or?
Yeah, no, I don't think that there has been anybody saying like, oh, Cultiva should work on domestic violence. But what has happened through our engagement with residents are sort of these conversations about, I'll give you a couple of examples. There was some efforts that we were doing to promote physical activity around a specific neighborhood, and we ended up establishing a walking group. And these women were having a lot of success in terms of losing weight, but also, and these were largely immigrant women, they were building connections with each other that was helping their emotional well-being as well. Well, there got to a point where some women were no longer coming. And when we were asking about that, one of the issues was that this woman had lost weight and her partner didn't want her to lose any more weight because she was becoming too attractive from his perspective. And he thought that he could lose her, right, if others found her attractive, right? So we've known things like that have happened. We've also had, conversations where we've been trying to bring people out to meetings. And they've told us things like, well, we can't go out during this time because if dinner's not ready, it causes problems in our home. Or people don't show up to a meeting because, a friend reports that she had a fight with her husband. So, those aren't things that we have been working on, but they've been things that have come up to us as a result of our work. So we know that it is impacting the communities that we work with. We know that it is an issue across, various social lines. And we know it's something that we need to work harder in Fresno if we're really working to create healthier communities. Part of that idea of creating healthier communities is strengthening our relationship and ties at a social level as well.
Once again, we are talking to Genoveva Islas, and she is the program director for Cultiva la Salud. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for reaching out to me, Monica.
Last week, for the first time, downtown Fresno's Soroyan Theater transformed into the Pride Lands, complete with larger-than-life giraffes and an iconic warthog-meerkat duo. With the North American tour of Disney's The Lion King halfway through its run in Fresno, FM 89's Laura Satsui sat down with two of the lead actors.
We're sitting here with Martina Sykes, who plays Shenzi, and Gerald Ramsey, who plays Mufasa for the U.S. tour of The Lion King. Martina and Gerald, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to start by asking you both about your characters. Gerald, let's start with you. You play, Mufasa, the original king of the Pride Lands. What should we know about your character that maybe we didn't gather if we've just watched the movie before?
Man, I think he's a lot more complex than people think. And that was something I had to learn coming into the show, I thought. I was told at least that, he's a king, he's a leader, period. But the more interesting part of him is that he's a father as well to Simba, and that's probably a story that gets explored more in the show. He's a husband, right? And he's a brother to Scar. But he's also one king in a long line of kings. So I feel like he has a great understanding of those who came before him and how he honors that as well as how he passes it on, mm-hmm. just like, we all do in our lives, I believe.
And then, Martina, you play Shenzi, who is a hyena. And I'll be honest, I feel like I've just seen the movie, and so I really wasn't on a first-name basis with this character. And so what should the audience know about her going in?
Shenzi, she is the boss. She is what girl power looks like. But on the villain standpoint, they think of her as or they think of the hyenas as Scar's henchmen. But really, they have the background plan. They know exactly what they're doing. And she heads up all of it.
And then one of the things I wanted to ask a little more about is you're on Scar's team. How do audiences react to that?
I think because we're the comedic relief, they respond to us pretty well because most of the time we're goofing off. And then we save the day because we eat Scar.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
One thing I think that's really notable about this tour is this is its debut in Fresno, and it's never been through before. And so I'm wondering, for someone who maybe has stuck around Fresno, seen a lot of theater here, but not this one, what do you think would be new for them? Maybe I'll get Gerald your thoughts first, and then Martina your thoughts. What's really unique about this show that if you've seen a lot of theater, you haven't seen before?
Well, first of all, it's equal pressure to be the debut company here, right, for such an iconic piece of theater and film, but we're also so humbled to be here to be that opportunity for, to be the first experience for people to see Lion King. I think no matter if you've seen the film before, or even if you've seen the show before, it changes as you change in your life. So no matter where you are in your life, believe me, you're going to relate to someone or something in the show, an event. And that's something that I think is necessary right now, is for us to realize no matter where you come from, we have a very mixed cast from all over the world. We're all related. We go through the same experiences. We're not all that different from each other. There's nothing to be afraid of.
Definitely. Martina, what about your thoughts? What do you think would be new for maybe someone who's seen a lot of shows but not this one?
I think I've seen a lot of theater, and nothing beats the first 5 minutes of this show. So just make sure you guys come here on time, because I always feel so bad when people are locked out. But there's nothing like it. It's so beautiful. It's so moving. And I think also because there's so many cultures in our show that people may recognize. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing like the first 5 minutes of the show.
Is it just the visuals? Is it the music? Or is it the whole experience?
The whole experience. I mean, you know, like Circle of Life from the film. But to actually see, and I'm pretty sure most people have seen either pictures of the Lion King on Broadway, but they're lifelike puppets. So to see like an elephant come down the aisles, or to see like the cheetah come out and the giraffes, like actually, how tall are they? They're like seven.
They're taller than me.
I think they're about 10, 12 feet tall. I'm not sure. But to see that come to life and to hear Rafiki's voice and the call and how people respond to it, I've never seen so many tears in my life watching a theater production.
Neither of you are new to the stage. What is unique about being a part of this cast since Gerald started first? Martina, do you want to start first?
I think because it's so diverse. Like, I learned so much from other people's culture. I learned from Gerald's culture. I learned from the South African culture. I learned a lot about my own culture. And we have, like, Balinese in there. We have, I think it's six different languages in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's just to see so many cultures being represented on stage at one time, I've never been a part of that.
Gerald, what about you? What's been unique about this experience?
To be honest, this is my first like major production to be a part of, so I'm relatively new to the theater stage. But much like the story and the music, how it connects to something deep inside of you, I realize where I come from in the South Pacific, we do have a history of telling stories through singing and dancing. And although it wasn't on a stage in a theater, as we perform hula or sivas from Samoa, like we are performing and telling stories, and we're passing those stories on and reminding each other of these life lessons we've learned through our past. And it's a great reminder of who I am. And then the chance to, as Mufasa, tell people, remember who you are.
And so you guys have a 16-show run in Fresno, I think, if I counted correctly. And I'm wondering, is it normal to have a really packed 2 weeks like that, or is this a little different from the rest of you guys' tour?
Yes, this is normal.
This is normal, okay.
Eight shows a week. We get Monday dark. Yeah, it's pretty
standard.
Yeah,
and there's days where you feel like, man, I'm exhausted and I'm tired. This is crazy. Eight times. When it gets to the weekend, like five shows back to back to back to back. But sometimes I have to remember that there are shows throughout the world. There are national tours of people on Broadway. There's nine Lion King productions around the world, and we're all doing this together, and we're bringing something positive to the world. So it's worth it. It's worth the exhaustion, as long as there's good food around.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I think you guys can definitely find that in Fresno, and I'm so glad that you guys are here with the tour. I'm really excited to see it. That's all the time that we have, but we've been speaking with Martina Sykes and Gerald Ramsey, who play Shenzi and Mufasa, respectively, for the U.S. tour of The Lion King. They're halfway through their two-week run at the Sorian Theater in Fresno. They'll be performing every evening from now until Sunday, including weekend matinees. Tickets are available, and you can find those and more information online at BroadwayInFresno.com. Martina and Gerald, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Fresno.
We continue our story about senior citizens targeted by housing scams.
71% of California seniors own their homes. And according to law enforcement, that has made them targets for predatory loans. KPBS's Amita Sharma reports organizations are selling seniors on the idea of renovation work they may not need. And sometimes homeowners don't realize they've taken on debt until it's too late.
How long did I live here? Ever since 1969. That's when my mom first bought the house, and it was all paid for.
Robert Unser lives on his own in a tiny San Diego house shrouded in shrubbery and American flags. He's 74 and a cancer survivor with cognitive disabilities. He lives on $11,000 a year from Social Security and gets help from local charity groups like Meals on Wheels.
How are you doing?
Hi. Good.
There you go.
Thanks.
Even though he doesn't cook for himself, he's got a brand new kitchen. Also, new energy-efficient windows and new solar panels on his roof. All told, he has taken out 4 loans on his home for improvements his lawyer says he didn't understand and doesn't need.
PACE loans are energy efficiency loans. They're used to finance only energy efficiency home improvement projects.
San Diego Legal Aid Society lawyer Katie Box says the high-interest, high-fee loans are peddled door-to-door, often to people who don't grasp their terms. The loan becomes a first-priority tax lien on a homeowner's property.
That means that the lien gets priority above any mortgage, above basically any other lien on the property.
I asked Unser about his 4 PACE loans.
I don't know where it came from. There was one bank wanted me to take out a loan for doing some of my work. I said, give me a few days once I sign a thing with, I forget.
Because of the PACE loans, he's seen his annual property taxes jump from $300 to $17,000, an amount he has no way to afford. Prosecutors say unscrupulous PACE lenders have taken advantage of seniors up and down the state. People like Unser, who is now at risk of losing his home.
These people are not going to make me homeless.
His lawyer, Katie Box, has sued Unser's PACE loan providers, Renovate America and Renew Financial, alleging fraud and breach of contract. The complaint is one of several that have been filed against the 2 loan providers, including class actions in Los Angeles County. Representatives from both institutions declined to comment specifically on the case because it's in litigation, though a Renovate America spokesman said there's no merit to Unser's lawsuit. Box disagrees.
It's very apparent from speaking with him that he doesn't understand these loans.
She thinks the lenders targeted him.
He is lonely, and everyone that knocks on his door, he invites in. So he invites them in, he talks to them, and they talk him into, hey, you need these windows replaced, you need your kitchen remodeled.
Box says Unser's PACE loans were finalized with electronic signatures on documents sent to non-existent email accounts. Unser doesn't have an email address, an internet connection, or a cell phone.
They literally made up a fake email address for him.
Laws took effect this year, requiring more state oversight of PACE providers. They will have to consider a person's ability to repay before approving the loans. But it's too late to help Unser, who is angry and stressed as his lawsuit plays out.
This thing has taken a very bad toll on me. They're not helping me. They're hurting me. They might as well just bury me and be done with it.
In San Diego, I'm Amita Sharma.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio, and on Twitter at kvpr.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Alice Daniel, and reporters Laura Satsui and Monica Velez. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Alice Daniel. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.